We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580. Good morning. I'm Bill Hammack. Today we're taking an intellectual adventure story, if you will. We look at the 350-year-old saga of the bones of the great French philosopher René Descartes. We'll track them as they traverse a continent. Their trek highlights the most momentous episodes in history, the birth of science, the rise of democracy, and the earliest debates between science and religion. My guest today has written Descartes' Bones, a Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And if you like, you can send a question via instant message using Bill Engineer Guy, all one word, on any IM system. So let's welcome to Focus 580, Russell Shorto.
Hi, Bill. Thanks very much for having me on.
Wonderful. So the history of the remains of Descartes is fascinating. And in the spring of 1666, his body was removed from his resting place near Stockholm, where it had been for about, I think, 16 years. And it was done under the cover of darkness, moved back to Rome. But and this started a fascinating journey. But let's start a little bit before that. Why was he in Stockholm?
He was in Stockholm because he had, over the course of his lifetime, he had become more and more famous and then infamous as people began to fear that his work was going to lead to secularism and atheism and basically the breakdown of society. And he wanted a lot of things. He wanted the fame. He wanted to change the way knowledge was structured. He thought the old knowledge was structured on a combination of received wisdom from the Bible and from the idea of the divine right of kings. He wanted to make it a what we would call a scientific basis. Mm-hmm. And but this also came with a lot of baggage and a lot of difficulty. And he accepted the invitation of Christina, the queen of Sweden, the mm-hmm. young upstart queen, then to come to Stockholm, where she was trying to build a royal court like that of Louis XIV, so he accepted this. She said that she wanted him to teach her philosophy, and she wanted to have a court and have him be sort of the intellectual centerpiece of it. And he thought, I think, also that it would be a chance to get away from the people who were hounding him. Mm-hmm.
So let's start the journey of that bones and use that, as you do in the book, to get into some of the philosophical issues. So they moved back to darkness to Paris. Who moved the bones, and what were they doing with them?
They were moved by a group of his followers, his devotees. They mm-hmm. called themselves Cartesians, mm-hmm. were scientists, philosophers. Many of them were Catholic priests. And they saw that they saw in his work something like what he had hoped it would be, that it would create a new foundation for knowledge. And in the 16 years from the time of his death, this influence spread across Europe. And since he had died in Stockholm, the idea was, it was kind of an interesting idea. The idea was really to, they were trying to win legitimacy for what they were doing in Paris and other parts of Europe, and they were trying to convince the powers that be in the church and in the state that this new thing, Cartesianism they called it, we would call it science, although it wasn't quite science yet, that it was something that was not a threat, but that was actually a tool that could be very useful. And they hit on the idea to use the bones of the master to help in this.
So you tell throughout the book this fascinating story of the bones, and we'll return to it throughout the interview. But as you're alluding there, you use this as a storytelling device to contextualize our thoughts about faith and reason. And what you really, it seems to me, want to do in this book is use the movement of the bones to tell the tale of how each generation struggles with the way Descartes poses fundamental questions about what it means to be human, about why we're here on Earth, and what, if any, purpose we have. So let's start with Descartes' famous dictum, I think, therefore I am. Now, I think today this seems trite and cliched. I mean, it's part of our intellectual DNA, as you point out in the book, and it's even fodder for jokes. I mean, George Carlin's I think, therefore I am, or I stink, therefore I am. Can you put in context what this revolutionary thought meant in the 17th century?
Yeah. As I said before, he himself, when he attended college, he attended one of the best Jesuit colleges mm-hmm. in Europe. And by the time he finished, he was a young man, and he felt disgusted, I guess, with the knowledge that he'd been fed. And he felt that it was all insubstantial, that the bases were not firm. And so he went off on a project. He decided that he would test each piece of knowledge that he had been taught. And he talks about this in a couple of his important books. The process he underwent, in which he was careful to say, this is a test, this is an experiment. And he was doing that because some of these pieces of knowledge that he was going to question were things like the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. They were things that if you challenged them, of course, you could get into trouble for. So he put it up as really a test, an experiment. And what he did is, one by one, he tested these things. And if they did not seem, as he said, clear and distinct, then he would put them to the side. And one by one, each of these pillars of education that he'd been taught, he found to be unsubstantial. And so he put them all to the side, and until he came to the one thing that could not be doubted. And that was, of course, that he was at this moment thinking these thoughts. It would be illogical to doubt that. So however flimsy that then, I think, therefore I am, there is someone, there's a brain thinking these thoughts. Mm-hmm. However insubstantial that seems, that is the one basis on which he would try to build a new structure for knowledge. And so that then becomes the bit, when the reason that that's so profound is because others, his contemporaries, saw that that then was a basis for building an approach to knowledge on, as Descartes called it, the human mind and its good sense. And from that, then, science, democracy, all of these grand projects of the modern world rest really on that basis.
So as you point out here, Descartes is the father of rationalism, of this scientific way to think. And as you've articulated his work here, he drove a wedge between reason and faith. But was Descartes himself a man of faith?
He seems to have been a very devout Catholic. There's some, of course, you can't, you know, you judge by someone's writings and their deeds. You can't necessarily see what's in their heart, looking back over history, or for that matter, with someone who's alive now. So there is some room for questioning it. And of the three leading living Descartes scholars who all helped me in one way or another with my book, one of them, the leading American scholar, thinks that Descartes was really kind of paying lip service to the Catholic Church. The leading French Descartes scholar thinks that, in fact, Descartes was a devout Catholic. And I agree with him because I think that at that time it was very difficult to move beyond the framework of faith that you were raised in.
So it did not seem then that Descartes felt his ideas in any way were alien to deep religious faith, as you point out, as a devout Catholic. So again, what did he think he was doing rather than look at how we interpret it today, which we'll get back to?
I think he was, you know, as I said before, he was trying to shore up knowledge, mm-hmm. and in doing that, he was trying to shore up faith because he saw that, you know, he was part of this generation. William Harvey doing his work about the circulation of the blood, mm-hmm. Francis Bacon, mm-hmm. Galileo, who were all exploring the natural world in a way that had never been done before. And the results they were getting sometimes conflicted with the body of knowledge that had been built up over the past generations, scholasticism, based on the writings of Aristotle and the church fathers and so on. Mm-hmm. So this then was a challenge to that. This new experimentation that was going was a challenge to that. And therefore, in many ways, was, of course, Galileo famously looking at the rings of Saturn and so on, and the church seeing this as a sign that an indication that the universe perhaps is not perfect, but the universe is God's creation. How could he have made an imperfect universe? What Descartes was trying to do was shore up faith, and doing that by putting faith in a certain category, so that the material world would be in one category and the realm of faith would be in another category. That was how he saw it.
So, while we're putting it in context in the time, let's look at philosophy. I mean, today philosophy has become a very academic field concerned, I think, often with narrow or less pejoratively technical problems. Can you put philosophy in context in the 17th and 18th centuries? What was the plight of philosophy then, and was it relegated to the sidelines?
Yeah, no, it really wasn't relegated to the sidelines. It was part of the debate about society and what direction it was going in. And as I say, these people were doing work that couldn't be denied and that was exciting and to some scary. It was really terrifying because it did threaten the foundations of knowledge. And philosophy had a role to play in this because philosophy was determining then, and what Descartes was trying to determine, and this is why Descartes became famous among his contemporaries, the other experimenters and philosophers of the time, because they saw that all this work they were doing challenged the received wisdom, but there was no new foundation, mm-hmm. and they saw in Descartes someone who was providing the basis for a new way to orient. To orient knowledge, and so what he was doing then was a project that was, you know, philosophy, as you say, you know, you could look at it in an arid, abstract way, and of course Descartes is today seen in this very abstract terms, but at the time he was very much a man of the world who. People railed at him in church pulpits as being an atheist. I mean, he was very much a figure in the news, as it were.
This is Focus 580, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Russell Shorto, author of Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, feel free to send a question via instant message on any IM system. Just use Bill Engineer Guy, all one word. So, you know, you mentioned here that philosophy at the time was a more intimate part of the debate and public discourse. His most famous book at the time was Discourse on Method, which I assume was written in Latin. Was that available then to everybody?
No, it was written in French, and he wrote it in French in order to. This was another one of the breaks with the past. And you know, Descartes is in many ways the first or one of the first modern thinkers, and not just for the ideas, but also for the decision to write it in the common language, of course, provided you could read French.
Mm-hmm.
And just to go one step further with that, he wrote in a fairly, I mean, for a philosopher, in a rather common manner, so that if you compare him with Spinoza, for example, who I think a lot of people today would say Spinoza was a superior philosopher, but Descartes was a better writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so just in terms of connecting with ordinary people, which is one thing he actually wanted to do, he framed it in the language and in the manner of speaking. He framed his work to be read.
So you make the point in the book that Descartes' thought was influenced by his daughter, although he never married. He had one child. Can you outline what you think this influence was?
Well, just in terms of Descartes and his personality and his mm-hmm. personal life,
mm-hmm.
he was, by most accounts, he was a brooding, vain, difficult man who had friends, but his friends tended to be devoted followers. And then whenever they crossed him, they were no longer his friends.
Mm-hmm.
So he was that sort. And he had, as far as we know, one intimate relationship, and it was with the housekeeper of a man he was staying with when he was staying in Amsterdam. And a child was born, and in fact he was sort of enough of a nerd that he wrote down the day that she was conceived. He made a note in his diary. And 9 months later, this daughter was born, named Francine, and she seems to have been the great love of his life. And she died then when she was 5 years old of scarlet fever, and that then really seems to have been the great loss of his life. And one of the things I do in try to do in the book is look at his work with some overlay of his personal life, because, of course, people don't write even philosophy in a vacuum. They do it in affected by their contemporaries, other thinkers, events in their lives, and in their personal lives. And the period of her birth, her life, and her death, you see at that time a change in his own philosophy. One of the interesting things about him is that he, and again, this gets back to the point about how he was he's seen as this abstract thinker, but really he started one of his great projects for the large part of his career was focused on very fundamental material scientific concerns. He looking under a microscope, looking at grains of salt, and trying to understand how things worked, and in particular how the human body worked. This gets back to, I think, his own childhood. He was a sickly child, and his parents were told by the doctors that he was going to die before he reached adulthood. And in fact, then when he was sent away to college, he got better, and that then seems to be the basis for this fascination with the human body. And he really, in common with his contemporaries, he had this notion that science was this tool or this toolbox, and which is, you know, a lot of people have this notion still today, and you could apply it to the human body. And the human body was a kind of machine, and if it is malfunctioning, you have to find the part of the body that's malfunctioning and fix it. You have to flip the right switch or turn the right knob, and then it will work properly. And when it does work properly, it could go on to live more or less forever. And this then, for a part of his career, was really his announced project, that he was a medical researcher. And so much so that when he died at the age of 53, some people in Europe were actually stunned, because they had been under the impression that he was really, this gets to the point of how the naive views of people had at that time of what science could achieve. They actually thought he was on this project of extending the human lifespan almost infinitely, and they were shocked that, you know, well, what do you mean he died? He was just going to extend human life. But the period of the birth and the death of his daughter, at that same time, his work changes, and I think it becomes broader and deeper and less focused on this kind of, let's cure disease, and more on the deeper, longer, harder problems of philosophy.
So just as you do in the book, let's bounce around and from Living Descartes and his ideas to his bones. After they were removed from Stockholm, where did they go? What happened to them in the next step?
You're right to say that I construct that the point of the book is really to look at what I think is this remarkable odd story of the bones of Descartes and what happens to them as a kind of metaphor, a series of metaphors for modernity and how a lot of these forces that Descartes unleashed or helped to unleash, how they have played out over the past centuries. And the first part of the story concerns when the bones are dug up in 1666 in Stockholm, and the very first piece of that story and piece of him concerns a man named Turlon, who was then the French ambassador to Stockholm. And he had been, as I said, the followers of Descartes in Paris had the idea to use his bones. They then appealed to him, and on their behalf, he appealed to the government in Sweden, asking for permission to move the bones of the great man to Paris. And he got permission, and they exhumed them. And Turlon then does something interesting. He asks permission to take a bone for himself, to take the right index finger bone. And he does this His doing this, I think, is interesting, and it speaks to this whole metaphorical use of the bones, because Turlon was a man of the world, but he was also a knight of Malta. He was a Christian warrior, and he understood that Descartes had been this important figure. But I think also, at that time, a lot of people, if you were trying to penetrate the heart of nature, to understand how the body worked and how the universe works and so on, mm-hmm. you were undertaking a spiritual inquiry. So you then, after death, he was treated in many circles, Descartes was, as a kind of saint. And so people, someone like Turlon, I mean, this gets to the whole use of relics and the veneration of relics throughout mm-hmm. medieval Europe. So Turlon takes a bone as a kind of religious relic of this figure. And that then becomes the first of the bones to go missing, because then the corpse has its own history as it moves across Europe.
So if we now bounce back to Descartes' thought, he laid the cornerstone of modern scientific thought, and his chief contribution, as I understand it from you, to modern science and philosophy was his radical focus on epistemology, on defining the boundaries of what we are capable of knowing with certainty. And at the center of this project was his mind-body dualism, the notion, I think, that a mind and its thoughts exist in a different category. Can you define a little more deeply the mind-body problem that philosophers are concerned with now?
Yeah, and it's mind-body dualism is something that's been around long before Descartes, and mm-hmm. it sounds very hard, and you know, it's a sort of, when you start talking about mind-body dualism, a lot of people want to leave the room, but it's actually a very ordinary fact of human existence. We exist in these two realms always at the same time. We exist in the realm of our minds and our thoughts, which, you know, we can entertain thoughts that were posed by Descartes or Aristotle or Jesus or whoever. And so there's this eternal sense of our being. And at the same time, we're chained to these bodies that are decaying and suffering. And how these two things fit together is, you might say, the mind-body problem. It's the conundrum of human existence, and that's has to do with why we have art, why we have poetry, as well as philosophy.
Well, as you point out, the idea of mind and body in various ways, maybe even body and soul, Paul in his letter to Romans mentions this, it's been around for a long time. What did Descartes do that really put this at the forefront? Was it his beautiful writing? Was it just the time for it?
It was the time for it, because this gets back to the point about at that generation. This is the birth of the modern and the birth of science, and when these people were doing this kind of work that challenged scholastic thought, it challenged the basis of on which human thought and human society had been built, and therefore epistemology, this philosophical question, became urgent. And so Descartes, one explanation for what he was trying to do was to reorient things so that we, society, could get on again and could move forward. What he and Galileo, what others in Europe at that moment were trying to do was to say, all right, we had this old foundation, which, you know, by the way, scholasticism existed for about 1,000 years, and it answered to a lot of people's satisfaction a lot of the basic questions of existence, but it was falling apart by this time.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to get back to the bones, we'll get back to the thoughts, but just like the book, I'm going to take a little side trip, because one of the great pleasures of this book is that it's like a conversation, and that it flows, but without a strict chronology. It takes time to go down a side road. For example, a bit of minutia that's in the book is about how Paris accomplished the startling feat of synchronized clocks that were stood in
public. You really are jumping somewhere else. Okay, go ahead.
Right.
Go ahead.
But this is also the nature of the book, which is, I think, wonderful. You know, how did they do this?
Okay, now you're in the early 20th century,
That's right.
you're talking about how they managed to synchronize the clocks that were set in principal street corners around Paris, and they did it with a water hydrology system that changed air would pump through and change the clocks, synchronize the clocks all around the city at the same time, and that was I brought that up in the book because that was a moment when I talk about when these clocks stopped functioning, because there was a great flood in Paris at the time, and the clock stopped functioning. And another consequence of that flood was the remains of Descartes, or most of them, by, where they were stored in a basement of a museum where they had been stored for a long time, were swept away along with a lot of other important bones.
So we're going to take a caller from on line one, a cell phone call. So line one, please go ahead.
Hi, I'd like you to speak to something a little different, and that is Descartes' belief that animals were specifically dogs, could feel no pain, that they were so different from humans, that they could feel no pain, yet in experiments he would cut them open without anesthesia and perform different techniques on them, yet that he would use them as animal models for humans in anatomy.
Yeah, that's a very odd point, which has gotten a lot of, you know, it's really stuck in people's minds. And I think what it gets to is his needing to, you know, I was talking before, I started to make the point about mind-body problem and how it related to theology. Mind and soul were in one category, and body, meaning the material world, was in another. But they have to be linked. Of course, they are linked in some way. And humans, here he's trying to make his philosophy conform to the church. And so that humans, the human mind, soul, body entity, is all of a piece. And the kind of the experience of suffering and pleasure and so on is all wrapped up in that. And so it was important for him in the way he structured this that that the human being be in its own category. And, you know, the human body was a machine and an animal body was a machine, but these two differed in a fundamentally important way, according to him.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with author Russell Shorto. We're talking about the conflict between faith and reason. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also send a question via instant message. Use any system in the world to Bill Engineer Guy. So I want to return now to the chronology of the bones. He has lost his finger so far. What's the next step in the travel for Descartes' bones?
So then a little delegation leads the bones on a pilgrimage, on a translation, to use the Catholic terminology, from Stockholm south to Paris. And there they are used by the Cartesians in Paris, who were... many of them were important figures in government, in the church, and as I say, they were trying to win legitimacy for their cause. And they used the bones then in this very kind of political way to convince the powers that be that this is not a thing to fear. And they held there was a parade across Paris, which mirrored the parade for the annual parade of the remains of Saint Genevieve, who was the patron saint of Paris. So it mirrors this, takes all the trappings of this medieval parade of relics. And thousands of people come out on the streets for this. And then they were, the bones were interred with great religious ceremony in the church of Saint Genevieve, next to the saint or near the saint. And then there's a series of banquets that are held around Paris to which they invite important figures in the church and in the state, all to win legitimacy, to say, look, we are what we are doing, what Descartes started and what we are carrying out is not something for you to fear, for the Vatican to censure, for the government to take the Cartesians who are in government and throw them out of office, but rather to see that this is part of life now. This is this project, which, you know, we would call science. This project is something that you have to accept because it's among us.
So let's then move to Descartes' thought today and what it means for us. In many ways, this book is an exploration of modernity. I mean, you're really after the root of why we believe and act in particular ways, which is a theme throughout your books. Your earlier book, The Island to the Center of the World, really looked at the roots and origins of American society. So can you articulate what is the dilemma that Descartes' reasoning sets up for us today that we have to solve and that every generation has to solve?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, one way of looking at it is what I was talking about before with Descartes and his contemporaries hitting on this notion of, you know, of exploring the natural world, drawing, looking at the body, for example, as a kind of machine, and working at it and then fixing it. So there was a naive aspect to that, as though the universe is a machine, the earth is a machine, the human body is, and that we can manipulate these, use these tools of science and fix it or make it optimum. And I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, science is a very powerful thing, and people at that time recognized it, and people today recognize it. But at the same time, science doesn't have this declarative universal power that people at that time were kind of fooled into thinking it has, and that I think people today, still in the back of our minds, we think that it has that kind of power. And the other side of that equation is, you know, there is today this continual confusion over the terrain of science and reason and the terrain of faith, whether, you know, is it true that, you know, there was a spate of books over the past few years by Christopher Hitchens and others basically saying, as Christopher Hitchens says very elegantly, that faith is part of the infancy of our species, and we should recognize that we've outgrown that stage. And there is that tendency in the modern Western secular world to think that. And there was that at the moment that this was all launched, that with the generation of Descartes and his contemporaries, there were already people who were saying, ah, we've hit on this new thing. All of that is old and it's in the past and we can start to bury it. And what you see and what the story of Descartes' bones, the metaphorical story there, reveals is in the 17th century, in the 18th century, in the 19th century, through to today, you see different ways in which this debate and this confusion over these two territories, how they play out, how that plays out, and whether people deciding whether the one supplants the other or whether the two actually fit together, and we just kind of have a hard time seeing how they do.
Well, in the book, very interestingly, you come down rather hard on Christopher Hitchens as intolerant as Islamic or Christian fundamentalist with his fundamental atheism, if you will. And it seems to me that what you're trying to say there is extreme views of faith and reason miss their mark in the worldviews, and that somewhere the answer is in between.
That's certainly my take. I think that I think it was, in a way, understandable that in the first or second or third blush in the modern era, it was understandable that people would say, oh, that other stuff, that's old and we've outgrown it now, so let's recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
I think by now we ought to have come to appreciate that science, reason, as profound as these things are, reason works on a particular spectrum of reality, and there are other parts of reality that simply doesn't have much sway over. The emotions, art, faith. I mean, these are parts of human experience that reason has a part in, but it doesn't have sort of mastery over. And so, I think one way to begin to resolve this dispute is to recognize that the range of experience, of human experience, is vast, and these are two different but potentially overlapping ways to negotiate it.
So there's a kind of pluralism to your approach. I was curious to see in your book that I didn't find the word scientism unless I missed it. Did you come across the literature on scientism at all? Did that word, you know, ring a bell?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I didn't use that term exactly.
Well, it's kind of ugly. Yeah.
I think maybe for
it's inelegant
aesthetic reasons. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here. That there's the idea of reducing—it's a reductionism. It's reducing all of reality to that which your tool happens to fit. You know, the old thing that, you know, if, you know, a carpenter will try to fix anything with a hammer. Well, certain things, you know, a hammer is not going to help.
So let us return to the bones again. So far, we have him being paraded around. I believe there's banquets going on. Did Descartes stay together after that, other than his finger?
We can move from that period in the 1660s. Then we can jump to jump ahead about a century. And in that century, of course, the seeds that Descartes and his contemporaries planted really start to bear fruit. The scientific industrial revolution gains sway, and it reaches reaches full flower with the American and the French revolutions then, when in the political sphere, these notions, I mean, even in Descartes' time, when he was saying, I think, therefore I am, and when people were beginning to appreciate that what it meant to say, I'm going to orient knowledge around my mind in its good sense. I am going to think, I'm going to apply my own individual reason to this situation. What that meant, it gave a lot of power to the individual, and therefore a lot of rights, and that then leads to politics. And even in the 1640s, 1650s, that early, you begin to see people talking about the rights of women, for example. If boys should be educated, why shouldn't girls? I mean, they have minds as well. So by the 1770s and 1780s, then you see that reaches its political expression with these two revolutions, which are very different, and they speak to two different kinds of enlightenment. What Jonathan Israel, the scholar, calls the radical enlightenment and the moderate enlightenment. The radical enlightenment is what you see embodied in the French Revolution, which was a revolution against the church as well as the king, against the state, whereas the American Revolution was really a revolution against a political system.
Russell, I want to return to those questions of civil society in a minute, but we have two callers, and I'd like to get to them. So our first caller is on line one from Champaign County. Line one, please go ahead.
Hi. I guess this battle has been fought out in my mind for quite a while, and I investigated it in a number of ways. And there's a late Swiss philosopher out of Berkeley called Paul Feyerabend who had an interesting book called Science in a Free Society, which has a blockbuster chapter called The Strange Case Against Astrology. Now.
And he also wrote Against Method, if I remember,
right.
His big book, yes.
Right. And he calls for epistemological anarchy, and it's sort of basically what you just said, is that science has some realms and it doesn't have others. But I wanted to bring that up as a point that it is a preoccupation, but also I just find it hilarious that his bones were venerated. I mean, it's absolutely, he would have absolutely been aghast. But in quantum physics has this chance proposal in it that actually undermines the whole idea of the Newtonian universe as well. So I don't know whether you want to comment on that. I mean, science what was science for so many years, the deterministic method, was actually undermined by its own insight.
Exactly. Yeah, that's sort of the next. That's a very good point, because that's the next layer to all of this. That what we're talking about in science with the century from Descartes through Newton is classical deterministic science, and what we've seen, what we saw in the course of the 20th century was the whole thing sort of turned inside out, which is gets back to the point of what I think, where I think the scientism or the kind of reductionistic view of religion, I think it points up the flaws with that as well, because I think that it indicates that in a very different way, using the language of science, that the world is much bigger and stranger than science allows.
So let's go ahead and move to another caller. We have a caller on line 4 from Effingham.
Yes. Could you address the appearance of existentialism? I think it was after Descartes, but nevertheless, it is in society today. And if you might comment on how it accrued and where it is now. Thank you.
So maybe that question is did existentialism grow out of Descartes' thought? Did he open up a hole where that could emerge from?
Yeah, well, existentialism is kind of a 20th century expression of some of the things we're talking about today, which, I mean, Descartes is one of these figures who is so elemental that, you know, you can pick up something on your desk and say, this comes from Descartes. Because he's so foundational. And yeah, sure, existentialism, because it is looking at, in a way, existentialism in terms of epistemology looks at the physical world around us and says this world has meaning in it. And so it carries part of, contemporary thinking has in it, it takes one aspect or another of Descartes' program and says and elevates it and says this is the most important.
So we have another caller. There's a caller on line 1 from Champaign. So line 1, please go ahead.
Thank you. Are you familiar with the writings and perhaps the video lectures as well of Bruce Lipton?
No.
He is somebody who's dealing very much with this whole thing you're talking about in terms of between science and spirit and between, what reductionism and what he likes to refer to as holism through an examination of the new field of epigenetics and what the implications of that are for our understanding of how evolution works. His first book was The Biology of Belief, and his new book that he co-authored is Spontaneous Evolution. You might want to examine those because it goes really to the heart of what you've been talking about and the implications of how we're not actually victims of our genes, that we have a great deal of influence over our genes. And, he does go into a scientific explanation of that, but also talks about, these very arguments over the span of history in terms of, and talks about Descartes having made, a deal with the devil in the form of the church in the sense of giving, the spirit and the unseen over to the church and, get it.
Caller, if I could interrupt here for just a second and recast your question a little bit. He's bringing in here that there are some books and some work that try to merge religious belief or the basis of it with a scientific basis. And maybe we should then move to what does modern neuroscience and philosophy say about Descartes' dualism, about the existence of mind and body? Does it support his assertions?
Well, there's a whole... this crosses a lot of different realms, and I think if you can pull a lot of it together, it basically says that if you're looking at the world of mind and the world of body, the material world, and trying to orient the two, what they come down on is a kind of materialism, but that isn't reductive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible to say that the material is all of reality, but that is only a there you are looking at the material as the stuff, but not as the simple explanation. In other words, it doesn't necessarily, a lot of these people would say, it doesn't necessarily do away with the stuff of the mind slash soul.
Mm-hmm. So I want to return to a point that you were making. I mean, earlier before the calls, another way to cast this book is as our journey from kind of medieval thinking, with grounded in the authority of the king and the church, to modernity's emphasis of individual reason as the basis for morality and politics. So how does Descartes' thought lead to the kind of civil society that we have today, or does it even lead to that?
Let me try to answer that by picking up what I was talking about before, because mm-hmm. you had asked me about the next step of the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking about the French Revolution and the American Revolution. And during the French Revolution, that's the next time that Descartes' bones enter history, because during the Revolution, and it was a revolution against the church and the state, the revolutionary leaders, the very church in which Descartes' bones had rested for about a century, had fallen into decay, and a new grand temple was being built. And then the revolution happens right as it was being finished, and the revolutionary government took it over and said, we are not, because, you know, at this time there was a desecration of churches around France, and they said, we are going to take this over, and we're going to make it a secular temple. So you see over and over again in this metaphorical use of the bones of Descartes how the features, the trappings of faith are used for secular purposes. So they say, we're going to make this a temple, a secular temple, which is the Pantheon, which still exists in Paris, and we will enshrine there the bones of great leaders, but without a religious underpinning to it. So then they begin, and it's interesting to see the records, to read the records of the revolutionary government, how they, in effect, stopped history to study that they voted on the various men. Voltaire, they voted right in, and a lot of people they disputed. And Descartes came up, and there was a great debate about whether or not Descartes should be included, because by this point, a lot of people look at Descartes as, in fact, the old way, that Descartes is representative of a line of thinking that, and this gets to a point about the difference between the French philosophy, the French Enlightenment, and the British. Because Descartes started something, but then the British picked it up and began using it in a very tactile way. You know, the British began developing small cottage industries, exploring new kinds of ceramics and new kinds of industries and factories, whereas the French thinking tended to be top-down. So by this point, a lot of people looked at Descartes as having sort of set that pattern and left France in the passenger seat. So there was a dispute then about whether or not he was, in fact, he had become kind of old-fashioned instead of modern. So this then actually becomes part of the French Revolution, and they eventually vote his remains in. But then the Reign of Terror breaks out,
mm-hmm.
and some of the very people who just voted him in suddenly are losing their heads, and instead his remains get pushed into a garden in a sarcophagus, and they then are forgotten about for a time. And then the next piece of interesting piece of the story comes up, which is around 1820, after the revolution now, and the French Academy of Science, I was talking about the top-down approach mm-hmm. that the French took. The French Academy of Science was very much a top-down organization, and as such, they set a lot of the framework for science as it has been ever since. They defined what the branches of science would be, what the categories and subdivisions and so on. And they it was brought to their attention that the remains of Descartes, there who they looked at as their intellectual grandparent, had been moldering in this garden since the revolution. So they then send a delegation of scientists, these are some of the greatest scientists of the day, to this garden. They open the sarcophagus to decide what to do with these remains. And lo and behold, what they find is there's no skull. So this then takes us all the way back to the beginning of the story in Stockholm, where, in fact, the skull was stolen. And the skull follows its own trajectory through history. And the rest of the bones have their path, so that even today the remains of Descartes are thought to be now in the Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés in Paris, and the skull is in the Musée de l'Homme, the anthropology museum in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, getting back to all these nice metaphors of that play out in the story of Descartes' bones, we're talking about the mind-body problem, and Descartes as kind of the father of that. Descartes had his own literal mind-body problem in that his skull was separated from the skeleton, and even today the skull, you know, talking about this division of science and faith, the skull is sitting in a science museum and the bones are buried in a church.
So the mind-body problem represents itself there in Descartes himself in a way, right?
There are a lot of these metaphors buried in the hidden in the bones.
Well, this is an extremely personal book, as you point out. It's narrative nonfiction. It uses history but isn't history. It's your own way to tell. And there's a sense in the book, to me, and I'm going to tread a borderline here, maybe I'm wrong, but that faith as an actual experience is a little bit foreign to you, that you seem to understand it intellectually. For example, when someone uses it to establish a social order, a social system. But I got the sense in the book it was hard for you to think in terms truly of a soul as a real thing.
Yeah, I would say that's true.
So, well, my question is do you have your own Descartes struggle going in your mind? Was this book a way to peer into yourself and your own beliefs and to probe and find out about those beliefs?
Yeah, since you're asking that kind of question, I was raised Catholic, the whole, you know, was an altar boy and so on, and then left it all in my teens. And then my first book was called Gospel Truth, and it was about the biblical scholars and the search for the historical Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in a way, quite similar to this in that that was an intellectual way to get back at the material that I was steeped in my childhood, and that I pushed aside. And so then with that book, I was following the work of archaeologists and historians who were examining the life of this first century Palestinian Jew, but just looking at it from the perspective of what can we determine here from the records, from the historical records? Did he exist? And, you know, all these basic questions. So there's a sense in several of my, I guess in all of my books, where, you know, there's something that's basic to you that you're working out as well.
Well, Russell, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you very much, Bill.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Russell Shorto, author of Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason.